This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Game, written and read by Neil Strauss, that being me. Copyright 2005 by Stately Plump Buck Mulligan. Production copyright 2009 by HarperCollins Publishers. In order to protect the identity of some women and members of the community, the nicknames and identifying characteristics of a small number of incidental characters in this book have been changed, and two minor characters are composites. Dedicated to the thousands of people I talk to in bars, clubs, malls, airports, grocery stores, subways, and elevators over the last 2 years. If you're reading this, I want you to know that I wasn't running game on you. I was being sincere. Really. You were different. I could not become anything. Neither bad nor good, neither a scoundrel nor an honest man, neither a hero nor an insect. And now I am eking out my days in my corner, taunting myself with the bitter and entirely useless consolation that an intelligent man cannot seriously become anything, that only a fool can become something. Fyodor Dostoevsky, Notes from Underground. Those who have read early drafts of this book have all asked the same questions. Is this true? Did it really happen? Are these guys for real? Thus, I find it necessary to employ an old literary device. The following is a true story. It really happened. Men will deny it, women will doubt it, but I present it to you here, naked, vulnerable, and disturbingly real. I beg you for your forgiveness in advance. Don't hate the player, hate the game. Step 1. Select a target. Meet mystery. The house was a disaster. Doors were split and smashed off their hinges. Walls were dented in the shape of fists, phones, and flower pots. Herbal was hiding in a hotel room scared for his life, and Mystery was collapsed on the living room carpet crying. He'd been crying for 2 days straight. This wasn't a normal kind of crying. Ordinary tears are understandable. But Mystery was beyond understanding. He was out of control. For a week he'd been vacillating between periods of extreme anger and violence, and jags of fitful, cathartic sobbing. And now, he was threatening to kill himself. There were five of us living in the house. Herbal, Mystery, Papa, Playboy, and myself. Boys and men came from every corner of the globe to shake our hands, take photos with us, learn from us, be us. They called me Style. It was a name I had earned. We never used our real names, only our aliases. Even our mansion, like the others we had spawned everywhere from San Francisco to Sydney, had a nickname. It was Project Hollywood. And Project Hollywood was a shambles. The sofas and dozens of throw pillows lining the floor of the sunken living room were fetid and discolored with the sweat of men and the juices of women. The white carpet had gone gray from the constant traffic of young, perfumed humanity herded in off Sunset Boulevard every night. Cigarette butts and used condoms floated grimly in the jacuzzi, and Mystery's rampage of the last few days had left the rest of the place totaled and the residents petrified. He was 6'5" and hysterical. "I can't tell you what this feels like," he choked out between sobs. His whole body spasmed. "I don't know what I'm going to do, but it will not be rational." He reached up from the floor and punched the stained red upholstery of the sofa as the siren wail of his despondency grew louder, filling the room with the sound of a grown male who has lost every characteristic that separates man from infant from animal. He wore a gold silk robe that was several sizes too small, exposing his scabbed knees. The ends of the sash just barely met to form a knot, and the curtains of the robe hung half a foot apart, revealing a pale, hairless chest, and below it, saggy gray Calvin Klein boxer shorts. The only other item of clothing on his trembling body was a winter cap pulled tight over his skull. It was June in Los Angeles. "This living thing," he was speaking again. "It's so pointless." He turned and looked at me through wet red eyes. "It's tic-tac-toe. There's no way you can win. So the best thing to do is not to play it." There was no one else in the house. I would have to deal with this. He needed to be sedated before he snapped out of tears and back into anger. Each cycle of emotions grew worse, and this time I was afraid he'd do something that couldn't be undone. I couldn't let Mystery die on my watch. He was more than just a friend. He was a mentor. He'd changed my life, as he had the lives of thousands of others just like me. I needed to get him Valium, Xanax, Vicodin, anything. I grabbed my phone book and scanned the pages for people most likely to have pills. People like guys in rock bands, women who just had plastic surgery, former child actors. But everyone I called wasn't home, didn't have any drugs, or claimed not to have any drugs because they didn't want to share. There was only one person left to call, the woman who had triggered Mystery's downward spiral. She was a party girl. She must have something. Katya, a petite Russian blonde with a Smurfette voice and the energy of a Pomeranian puppy, was at the front door in 10 minutes with a Xanax and a worried look on her face. "Don't come in," I warned her. "He'll probably kill you." Not that she didn't entirely deserve it, of course. Or so I thought at the time. I gave Mystery the pill and a glass of water and waited until the sobs slowed to a sniffle. Then I helped him into a pair of black boots, jeans, and a gray t-shirt. He was docile now, like a big baby. I walked him outside to my old Corvette and stuffed him into the tiny front seat. Every now and then, I'd see a tremor of anger flash across his face or a tear roll out of his eyes. I hoped he'd remain calm long enough for me to help him. "I want to learn martial arts," he said docilely. "So when I want to kill someone, I can do something about it." I stepped on the accelerator. Our destination was the Hollywood Mental Health Center on Vine Street. It was an ugly slab of concrete surrounded day and night by homeless men who screamed at lampposts, transvestites who lived out of shopping carts, and other remaindered human beings who set up camp where free social services could be found. Mystery, I realized, was one of them. He just happened to have charisma and talent, which drew others to him and prevented him from ever being left alone in the world. He possessed two traits I noticed in nearly every rock star I've ever interviewed. A crazy-driven gleam in his eyes, and an absolute inability to do anything for himself. I brought him into the lobby, signed him in, and together we waited for a turn with one of the counselors. He sat in a cheap plastic black chair, staring catatonically at the institutional blue walls. An hour passed. He began to fidget. 2 hours passed. His brow furrowed, his face clouded. 3 hours passed. The tears started. 4 hours passed. He bolted out of his chair and ran out of the waiting room and through the front door of the building. He walked briskly, like a man who knew where he was going, although Project Hollywood was 3 miles away. I chased him across the street and caught up to him outside a mini mall. I took his arm and turned him around, baby-talking him back into the waiting room. 5 minutes. 10 minutes. 20 minutes. 30. He was up and out again. I ran after him. Two social workers stood uselessly in the lobby. "Stop him," I yelled. "We can't," one of them said. "He's left the premises." "So you're just going to let a suicidal man walk out of here?" I couldn't waste time arguing. "Just have a therapist ready to see him if I get him back here." I ran out the door and looked to my right. He wasn't there. I looked left. Nothing. I ran north to Fountain Street, spotted him around the corner, and dragged him back again. When we arrived, the social workers led him down a long hallway and into a claustrophobic cubicle with a sheet vinyl floor. The therapist sat behind a desk, running a finger through a black tangle in her hair. She was a slim Asian woman, in her late 20s, with high cheekbones, dark red lipstick, and a pinstriped pantsuit. Mystery slumped in a chair across from her. "So how are you feeling today?" she asked, forcing a smile. "I'm feeling," Mystery said, "like there's no point to anything." He burst into tears. "I'm listening," she said, scrawling a note on her pad. The case was probably already closed for her. "So, I'm removing myself from the gene pool," he sobbed. She looked at him with feigned sympathy as he continued. To her, he was just one of a dozen nut jobs she saw a day. All she needed to figure out was whether he required medication or institutionalization. "I can't go on," Mystery went on. "It's futile." With a rote gesture, she reached into a drawer, pulled out a small package of tissues, and handed it to him. As Mystery reached for the package, he looked up and met her eyes for the first time. He froze and stared at her silently. She was surprisingly cute for a clinic like this. A flicker of animation flashed across Mystery's face, then died. "If I had met you in another time and in another place," he said, as he crumpled the tissue in his hands, "things would have been different." His body, normally proud and erect, curved like soggy macaroni in his chair. He stared glumly at the floor as he spoke. "I know exactly what to say and what to do to make you attracted to me," he continued. "It's all in my head. Every rule, every step, every word. I just can't do it right now." She nodded mechanically. "You should see me when I'm not like this," he continued slowly, sniffling. "I've dated some of the most beautiful women in the world. Another place, another time, and I would have made you mine. Yes, she said, patronizing him. I'm sure you would have. She didn't know. How could she? But this sobbing giant with a crumpled tissue in his hand was the greatest pickup artist in the world. That was not a matter of opinion, but fact. I'd met scores of the self-proclaimed best in the previous 2 years, and mystery could outgame them all. It was his hobby, his passion, his calling. There was only one person alive who could possibly compete with him, and that man was sitting in front of her also. From a formless lump of nerd, mystery had molded me into a superstar. Together, we had ruled the world of seduction. We had pulled off spectacular pickups before the disbelieving eyes of our students and disciples in Los Angeles, New York, Montreal, London, Melbourne, Belgrade, Odessa, and beyond. And now, we were in a madhouse. Meet Style. I am far from attractive. My nose is too large for my face, and while not hooked, has a bump in the ridge. Though I'm not bald, to say that my hair is thinning would be an understatement. There are just wispy, Rogaine-enhanced growths covering the top of my head like tumbleweeds. In my opinion, my eyes are small and beady, though they do have a lively glimmer, which is doomed to remain my secret because no one can see it behind my glasses. I have indentations on either side of my forehead, which I like and believe add character to my face, though I've never actually been complimented on them. I'm shorter than I'd like to be, and so skinny that I look malnourished to most people, no matter how much I eat. When I look down at my pale, slouched body, I wonder why any woman would want to sleep next to it, let alone embrace it. So for me, meeting girls takes work. I'm not the kind of guy women giggle over at a bar or want to take home when they're feeling drunk and crazy. I can't offer them a piece of my fame and bragging rights like a rock star or cocaine in a mansion like so many other men in Los Angeles. All I have is my mind, and nobody can see that. You may notice that I haven't mentioned my personality. This is because my personality has completely changed. Or, to put it more accurately, I completely changed my personality. I invented Style, my alter ego. And in the course of 2 years, Style became more popular than I ever was, especially with women. It was never my intention to change my personality or walk through the world under an assumed identity. In fact, I was happy with myself and my life. That is, until an innocent phone call, it always starts with an innocent phone call, led me on a journey into one of the oddest and most exciting underground communities that, in 15 years of journalism, I have ever come across. The call was from Jeremy Ruby Strauss, no relation, a book editor who had stumbled across a document on the internet called The Lay Guide, short for the How to Lay Girls Guide. Compressed into 150 sizzling pages, he said, was the collected wisdom of dozens of pickup artists who had been exchanging their knowledge in newsgroups for nearly a decade, secretly working to turn the art of seduction into an exact science. The information needed to be rewritten and organized into a coherent how-to book, and he thought I was the man to do it. I wasn't so sure. I want to write literature, not give advice to horny adolescents. But, of course, I told him it wouldn't hurt to take a look at it. The moment I started reading, my life changed. More than any other book or document, be it the Bible, Crime and Punishment, or The Joy of Cooking, The Lay Guide opened my eyes. And not necessarily because of the information in it, but because of the path it sent me hurtling down. When I look back on my teenage years, I have one major regret, and it has nothing to do with not studying hard enough, not being nice to my mother, or crashing my father's car into that public bus. It is simply that I didn't fool around with enough girls. I'm a deep man. I reread James Joyce's Ulysses every 3 years for fun. I consider myself reasonably intuitive. I'm at core a good person, and I try to avoid hurting others. But I can't seem to evolve to the next stage of being, because I spend far too much time thinking about women. And I know I'm not alone. When I first met Hugh Hefner, he was 73. He had slept with over 1,000 of the most beautiful women in the world, by his own account. But all he wanted to talk about were his 3 girlfriends, Mandy, Brandy, and Sandy. And how, thanks to Viagra, he could keep them all satisfied. Though his money probably satisfied them enough. If he ever wanted to sleep with somebody else, he said, the rule was that they'd all do it together. So what I gathered from the conversation was that here was a guy who'd had all the sex he wanted his whole life, and at 73 he's still chasing tail. When does it stop? If Hugh Hefner isn't over it yet, when am I going to be? If The Lay Guide had never crossed my path, I, like most men, would never have evolved in my thinking about the opposite sex. In fact, I probably started off worse than most men. In my preteen years, there were no games of doctor, no girls who charged a dollar to look up their skirts, no tickling classmates in places I wasn't supposed to touch. I spent most of my teenage life grounded, so when my sole adolescent sexual opportunity occurred, a drunken freshman girl called and offered me a blowjob. I was forced to decline, or else suffer my mother's wrath. In college, I began to find myself. The things I was interested in, the personality I'd always been too shy to express, a group of friends who'd expand my mind with drugs and conversation, in that order. But I never became comfortable around women. They intimidated me. In 4 years of college, I did not sleep with a single woman on campus. After school, I took a job at the New York Times as a cultural reporter, where I began to build confidence in myself and my opinions. Eventually, I gained access to a privileged world where no rules applied. I went on the road with Marilyn Manson and Motley Crue to write books with them. In all that time, with all those backstage passes, I didn't get so much as a single kiss from anyone except Tommy Lee. After that, I pretty much gave up hope. Some guys had it, other guys didn't. I clearly didn't. The problem wasn't that I'd never been laid. It was that the few times I did get lucky, I'd turn a one-night stand into a 2-year stand because I didn't know when it was going to happen again. The Lay Guide had an acronym for people like me, AFC, Average Frustrated Chump. I was an AFC, not like Dustin. I met Dustin the year I graduated from college. He was friends with a classmate of mine named Marco, a faux aristocratic Serbian who had been my companion in girllessness since nursery school, thanks largely to his head, which was shaped like a watermelon. Dustin wasn't any taller, richer, more famous, or better looking than either of us, but he did possess one quality we didn't. He attracted women. When Marco first introduced me to him, I was unimpressed. He was short and swarthy, with long curly brown hair and a cheesy button-down gigolo shirt with too many buttons undone. That night, we went to a Chicago club called Drink. As we checked our coats, Dustin asked, "Do you know if there are any dark corners in here?" I asked him what he needed dark corners for, and he replied that they were good places to take girls. I raised my eyebrows skeptically. Minutes after entering the bar, however, he made eye contact with a shy-looking girl who was talking with a friend. Without a word, Dustin walked away. The girl followed him, straight to a dark corner. When they finished kissing and groping, they parted wordlessly, without an obligatory exchange of phone numbers or even a sheepish "see you later." Dustin repeated this seemingly miraculous feat 4 times that night. A new world opened up before my eyes. I grilled him for hours, trying to determine what sort of magical powers he possessed. Dustin was what they call a natural. He had lost his virginity at age 11, when the 15-year-old daughter of a neighbor used him as a sexual experiment, and he had been fucking nonstop since. One night, I took him to a party on a boat anchored in New York's East River. When a sultry brown-haired doe-eyed girl walked by, he turned to me and said, "She's just your type." I denied it and stared at the floor, as usual. I was afraid he'd try to make me talk to her, which he soon did. When she walked past again, he asked her, "Do you know Neil?" It was a stupid icebreaker, but it didn't matter now that the ice was broken. I stammered out a few words until Dustin took over and rescued me. We met her and her boyfriend at a bar afterward. They had just moved in together. Her boyfriend was taking their dog for a walk. So after a few drinks, he took the dog home, leaving the girl, Paula, with us. Dustin suggested going back to my place to cook a late-night snack, so we walked to my tiny East Village apartment and instead collapsed on the bed, with Dustin on one side of Paula and myself on the other. When Dustin started kissing her left cheek, he signaled me to do the same on her right cheek. Then, in synchronicity, we moved down her body to her neck and her breasts. Though I was surprised by Paula's quiet compliance, for Dustin, this seemed to be business as usual. He turned to me and asked if I had a condom. I found one for him. He pulled off her pants and moved into her while I continued lapping uselessly at her right breast. That was Dustin's gift, his power, giving women the fantasy they never thought they'd experience. Afterward, Paula called me constantly. She wanted to talk about the experience all the time, to rationalize it, because she couldn't believe what she had done. That's how it always worked with Dustin. He got the girl, I got the guilt. I chalked this up to a simple difference of personality. Dustin had a natural charm and animal instinct that I just didn't. Or at least, that's what I thought, until I read the Lay Guide and explored the newsgroups and websites it recommended. what I discovered was an entire community filled with Dustins, men who claimed to have found the combination to unlock a woman's heart and legs, along with thousands of others like myself, trying to learn their secrets. The difference was that these men had broken down their methods to a specific set of rules that anybody could apply, and each self-proclaimed pickup artist had his own set of rules. There was Mystery, a magician, Ross Jeffries, a hypnotist, Rick H., a trust fund millionaire, David D'Angelo, a real estate agent, Juggler, a stand-up comedian, David X., a construction worker, and Steve P., a seductionist so powerful that women actually pay him to learn how to give him better head. Put them on South Beach in Miami, and any number of better-looking, muscle-bound bullies will be kicking sand in their pale, emaciated faces. But put them in a Starbucks or whiskey bar, and they'll be taking turns making out with that bully's girlfriend as soon as his back is turned. Once I discovered their world, the first thing that changed was my vocabulary. Terms like AFC, or Average Frustrated Chump, PUA, or PUA, an acronym for pickup artist, SARGing, which means picking up women, and HB, an acronym for hot babe, entered my permanent lexicon. Then my daily ritual changed as I became addicted to the online locker room these pickup artists had created. Whenever I returned home from meeting or going out with a woman, I sat down at my computer and posted my questions of the night on the newsgroups. What do I do if she says she has a boyfriend? If she eats garlic during dinner, does it mean she isn't planning on kissing me? Is it a good or a bad sign when a girl puts on lipstick in front of me? And online characters like Candor, Gunwitch, and Form Handle began replying to my questions. The answers, in order: use a boyfriend destroyer pattern, you're overanalyzing this, neither. Soon I realized this was not just an internet phenomenon, but a way of life. There were cults of wannabe seductionists in dozens of cities, from Los Angeles to London to Zagreb to Bombay, who met weekly in what they called lairs to discuss tactics and strategies before going out en masse to meet women. In the guise of Jeremy Ruby Strauss and the internet, God had given me a second chance. It wasn't too late to be Dustin, to become what every woman wants. Not what she says she wants, but what she really wants, deep inside, beyond her social programming, where her fantasies and daydreams lie. But I couldn't do it on my own. Talking to guys online was not going to be enough to change a lifetime of failure. I had to meet the faces behind the screen names, watch them in the field, find out who they were and what made them tick. I made it my mission, my full-time job and obsession, to hunt down the greatest pickup artists in the world and beg for shelter underneath their wings. And so began the strangest 2 years of my life. Step 2. Approach and open. Chapter 1. I withdrew $500 from the bank, stuffed it into a white envelope, and wrote Mystery on the front. It was not the proudest moment of my life. But I had dedicated the last 4 days to getting ready for it anyway, buying $200 worth of clothing at Fred Siegel, spending an afternoon shopping for the perfect cologne, and dropping $75 on a Hollywood haircut. I wanted to look my best. This would be my first time hanging out with a real pickup artist. His name, or at least the name he used online, was Mystery. He was the most worshipped pickup artist in the community, a powerhouse who spit out long, detailed posts that read like algorithms of how to manipulate social situations to meet and attract women. His nights out seducing models and strippers in his hometown of Toronto were chronicled in intimate detail online, the writing filled with jargon of his own invention. Sniper negs, shotgun negs, group theory, IOIs, pawning, all of which had become an integral part of the pickup artist lexicon. For 4 years, he had been offering his advice for free in seduction newsgroups. Then, in October, he decided to put a price on himself and posted the following. Mystery is now producing basic training workshops in several cities around the world due to numerous requests. The first workshop will be in Los Angeles from Wednesday evening, October 10, through Saturday night. The fee is $500 US. This includes club entry, limo for 4 evenings, an hour lecture in the limo each evening with a 30-minute debriefing at the end of the night, and finally, 3.5 hours per night in field, broken up into 2 clubs per night, with Mystery. by the end of basic training, you will have approached close to 50 women. It is no easy feat to sign up for a workshop dedicated to picking up women. To do so is to acknowledge defeat, inferiority, and inadequacy. It is to finally admit to yourself that after all these years of being sexually active, or at least sexually cognizant, you have not grown up and figured it out. Those who ask for help are often those who have failed to do something for themselves. So if drug addicts go to rehab, and the violent go to anger management class, then social retards go to pickup school. Pressing send on my email to Mystery was one of the hardest things I'd ever done. If anyone, friends, family, colleagues, and especially my lone ex-girlfriend in Los Angeles, found out I was paying for live in-field lessons on picking up women, the mockery and recrimination would be instant and merciless. So I kept my intentions secret, dodging social plans by telling people that I was going to be showing an old friend around town all weekend. I would have to keep these worlds separate. In my email to Mystery, I didn't tell him my last name or my occupation. If pressed, I planned to just say I was a writer and leave it at that. I wanted to move through this subculture anonymously, without either an advantage or extra pressure because of what I did for a living. However, I still had my own conscience to deal with. This was, far and away, the most pathetic thing I'd done in my life. And unfortunately, as opposed to, say, masturbating in the shower, it wasn't something I could do alone. Mystery and the other students would be there to bear witness to my shame, my secret, my inadequacy. A man has two primary drives in early adulthood, one toward power, success, and accomplishment, the other toward love, companionship, and sex. Half of life, then, was out of order. To go before them was to stand up as a man and admit that I was only half a man. Chapter 2. A week after sending the email, I walked into the lobby of the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. I wore a blue wool sweater that was so soft and thin it looked like cotton, black pants with laces running up the sides, and shoes that gave me a couple extra inches in height. My pockets bulged with the supplies Mystery had instructed every student to bring: a pen, a notepad, a pack of gum, and condoms. I spotted Mystery instantly. He was seated regally, in a Victorian armchair, with a smug, I-just-bench-pressed-the-world smile on his face. He wore a casual, loose-fitting blue-black suit, a small pointed lebret piercing wagged from his chin, and his nails were painted jet black. He wasn't necessarily attractive, but he was charismatic, tall and thin, with long chestnut hair, high cheekbones, and a bloodless pallor. He looked like a computer geek who'd been bitten by a vampire and was midway through his transformation. Next to him was a shorter, intense-looking character who introduced himself as Mystery's wing, Sin. He wore a form-fitting black crewneck shirt, and his hair was pitch black and gelled straight back. He had the complexion, however, of a man whose natural hair color is red. I was the first student to arrive. "What's your top score?" Sin leaned in and asked as I sat down. They were already assessing me, trying to figure out if I was in possession of a thing called game. "My top score?" "Yeah, how many girls have you been with?" "Somewhere around 7, I told them. "Somewhere around 7, Sin pressed. "6, I confessed. Sin ranked in the 60s, Mystery in the 100s. I looked at them in wonder. These were the pickup artists whose exploits I'd been following so avidly online for months. They were another class of being to me. They had the magic pill, the solution to the inertia and frustration that had plagued the great literary protagonists I'd related to all my life, be it Leopold Bloom, Alex Portnoy, or Piglet from Winnie the Pooh. As we waited for the other students, Mystery threw a manila envelope full of photographs in my lap. "These are some of the women I've dated," he said. In the folder was a spectacular array of beautiful women, a headshot of a sultry Japanese actress, an autographed publicity still of a brunette who bore an uncanny resemblance to Liv Tyler, a glossy picture of a penthouse pet of the year, a snapshot of a tan, curvy stripper in a negligee who Mystery said was his girlfriend, Patricia, and a photo of a brunette with large silicone breasts which were being suckled by Mystery in the middle of a nightclub. These were his credentials. "I was able to do that by not paying attention to her breasts all night," he explained when I asked about the last shot. "A pickup artist must be the exception to the rule. You must not do what everyone else does ever. I listened carefully. I wanted to make sure every word etched itself on my cerebral cortex. I was attending a significant event. The only other credible pickup artist teaching courses was Ross Jeffries, who had basically founded the community in the late 1980s. But today marked the first time seduction students would be removed from the safe environs of the seminar room and let loose in clubs to be critiqued as they ran game on unsuspecting women. A second student arrived, introducing himself as Extra Mask. He was a tall, gangly, impish, 25-year-old with a bowl cut, overly baggy clothing, and a handsomely chiseled face. With the right haircut and outfit, he would easily have been a good-looking guy. When Sin asked him what his count was, Extra Mask scratched his head uncomfortably. "I have virtually zero experience with girls," he explained. "I've never kissed a girl before." "You're kidding," Sin said. "I've never even held a girl's hand. I grew up pretty sheltered. My parents were really strict Catholics, so I always had a lot of guilt about girls." The next arrival was a tanned, balding man in his 40s who'd flown in from Australia just to attend the workshop. He had a $10,000 Rolex, a charming accent, and one of the ugliest sweaters I'd ever seen. A thick, cable-knit monstrosity with multicolored zigzags that looked like the aftermath of a finger-painting mishap. He reeked of money and confidence. Yet the moment he opened his mouth to give Sin his score, 5, he betrayed himself. His voice trembled. He couldn't look anyone in the eye, and there was something pathetic and childlike about him. His appearance, like his sweater, was just an accident that spoke nothing of his nature. He was new to the community and reluctant to share even his first name, so Mystery christened him Sweater. The three of us were the only students in the workshop. "Okay, we've got a lot to talk about," Mystery said, clapping his hands together. He leaned in close so the other guests in the hotel couldn't hear. "My job here is to get you into the game," he continued, making piercing eye contact with each of us. "I need to get what's in my head into yours. Think of tonight as a video game. It's not real. Every time you do an approach, you're playing this game." My heart began pounding violently. The thought of trying to start a conversation with a woman I didn't know petrified me, especially with these guys watching and judging me. Bungee jumping and parachuting were a cakewalk compared to this. "All your emotions are going to try and fuck you up," Mystery continued. "They are there to try to confuse you. So know right now that they cannot be trusted at all. You'll feel shy sometimes and self-conscious, and you must deal with it like you deal with a pebble in your shoe. It's uncomfortable, but you ignore it. It's not part of the equation." Mystery paused to order a Sprite with 5 slices of lemon on the side, then told us his story. He spoke in a loud, clear voice, modeled, he said, on the motivational speaker Anthony Robbins. Everything about him seemed to be a conscious, rehearsed invention. Since the age of 11, when he beat the secret to a card trick out of a classmate, Mystery's goal in life was to become a celebrity magician, like David Copperfield. He spent years studying and practicing, and managed to parlay his talents into birthday parties, corporate gigs, and even a couple talk shows. In the process, however, his social life suffered. At the age of 21, when he was still a virgin, he decided to do something about it. "One of the world's great mysteries is the mind of a woman," he told us grandiosely. "So I set out to solve it." He took a half-hour bus ride into Toronto every day, going to bars, clothing stores, restaurants, and coffee shops. He wasn't aware of the online community or any other pickup artists, so he was forced to work alone, relying on the one skill he did know, magic. It took him dozens of trips to the city before he even worked up the guts to talk to a stranger. From there, he tolerated failure, rejection, and embarrassment, day and night, until, piece by piece, he put together the puzzle that is social dynamics and discovered what he believed to be the patterns underlying all male-female relationships. "It took me 10 years to discover this," he said. "The basic format is FMAC, find, meet, attract, close. Believe it or not, the game is linear. A lot of people don't know that." For the next half hour, Mystery told us about what he called group theory. "I have done this specific set of events a bazillion times," he said. "You do not walk up to a girl who's all by herself. That is not the perfect seduction. Women of beauty are rarely found alone. After approaching the group, he continued, the key is to ignore the woman you desire while winning over her friends, especially the men and anyone else likely to cockblock. If the target is attractive and used to men fawning all over her, the pickup artist must intrigue her by pretending to be unaffected by her charm. This is accomplished through the use of what he called a neg. Neither compliment nor insult, a neg is something in between, an accidental insult or backhanded compliment. The purpose of a neg is to lower a woman's self-esteem while actively displaying a lack of interest in her, by telling her she has lipstick on her teeth, for example, or offering her a piece of gum after she speaks. I don't alienate ugly girls. I don't alienate guys. I only alienate the girls I want to fuck, Mystery lectured, eyes blazing with the conviction of his aphorisms. If you don't believe me, you'll see it tonight. Tonight is the night of experiments. First, I'm going to prove myself. You are going to watch me, and then we are going to push you to try a few sets. Tomorrow, if you do what I say, you'll be able to make out with a girl within 15 minutes. He looked at Extramask. Name the 5 characteristics of an alpha male. Confidence? Right, what else? Strength? No. Body odor? He turned to Sweater and me. We were also clueless. The number one characteristic of an alpha male is the smile, he said, beaming an artificial beam. Smile when you enter a room. As soon as you walk in a club, the game is on. And by smiling, you look like you're together, you're fun, and you're somebody. He gestured to Sweater. When you came in, you didn't smile when you talked to us. That's just not me, Sweater said. I look silly when I smile. If you keep doing what you've always done, you'll keep getting what you've always gotten. It's called the mystery method because I'm mystery and it's my method. So what I'm going to ask is that you indulge in some of my suggestions and try new things over the next 4 days. You are going to see a difference. Besides confidence and a smile, we learned, the other characteristics of an alpha male were being well-groomed, possessing a sense of humor, connecting with people, and being seen as the social center of a room. No one bothered to tell Mystery that those were actually 6 characteristics. As Mystery dissected the alpha male further, I realized something. The reason I was here, the reason Sweater and Extramask were also here, was that our parents and our friends had failed us. They had never given us the tools we needed to become fully effective social beings. Now, decades later, it was time to acquire them. Mystery went around the table and looked at each of us. What kind of girls do you want? He asked Sweater. Sweater pulled a piece of neatly folded notebook paper out of his pocket. Last night I wrote down a list of goals for myself, he said, unfolding the page, which was filled with 4 columns of numbered items. And one of the things I'm looking for is a wife. She needs to be smart enough to hold up her end of any conversation and have enough style and beauty to turn heads when she walks into a room. Well, look at you, Mystery said. You look average. People think if they look generic, then they can seduce a wide array of women. Not true. You have to specialize. If you look average, you're going to get average girls. Your khaki pants are for the office. They're not for clubs. And your sweater? Burn it. You need to be bigger than life. I'm talking over the top. If you want to get the tens, you need to learn peacock theory. Mystery loved theories. Peacock theory is the idea that in order to attract the most desirable female of the species, it's necessary to stand out in a flashy and colorful way. For humans, he told us, the equivalent of the fanned peacock tail is a shiny shirt, a garish hat, and jewelry that lights up in the dark. Basically, everything I dismissed my whole life as cheesy. When it came time for my personal critique, Mystery had a laundry list of fixes. Get rid of the glasses, shape the overgrown goatee, shave the expensively trimmed tumbleweeds on my head, dress more outrageously, wear a conversation piece, get some jewelry, get a life. I wrote down every word of advice. This was a guy who thought about seduction nonstop, like a mad scientist working on a formula for zero-gravity fuel. The archive of his internet messages was 3,000 posts long, more than 2,500 pages, all dedicated to cracking the code that is woman. I have an opener for you to use, he said to me. An opener is a prepared script used to start a conversation with a group of strangers. It's the first thing anyone who wants to meet women must be armed with. Say this when you see a group with a girl you like. Hey, it looks like the party's over here. Then turn to the girl you want and add, if I wasn't gay, you'd be so mine. A flash of crimson burned up my face. "Really?" I asked. "How is that going to help?" "Once she's attracted to you, it won't matter whether you said you were gay or not." "But isn't that lying?" "It's not lying," he replied. "It's flirting." To the group, he offered other examples of openers. Innocent but intriguing questions like, "Do you think magic spells work?" Or, "Oh my God, did you see those two girls fighting outside?" Sure, they weren't that spectacular or sophisticated, but all they are meant to do is get two strangers talking. The point of mystery method, he explained, is to come in under the radar. Don't approach a woman with a sexual come-on. Learn about her first and let her earn the right to be hit on. An AFC hits on a woman right away, he decreed as he rose to leave the hotel. A pro waits 8 to 10 minutes. Armed with mystery's negs, group theory, and camouflage openers, we were ready to hit the clubs. Chapter 3. We piled into the limo and drove to the Standard Lounge, a velvet rope-guarded hotel hotspot. It was here that mystery shattered my whole model of reality. Limits I had once imposed on human interaction were extended far beyond what I ever thought possible. The man was a machine. The Standard was dead when we walked in. We were too early. There were just two groups of people in the room, a couple near the entrance and two couples in the corner. I was ready to leave, but then I saw Mystery approach the people in the corner. They were sitting on opposite couches across a glass table. The men were on one side. One of them was Scott Baio, the actor best known for playing Chachi on Happy Days. Across from him were two women, a brunette and a bleached blonde, who looked like she'd stepped out of the pages of Maxim. Her cut-off white t-shirt was suspended so high into the air by fake breasts that the bottom of it just hovered, flapping in the air, above a belly tightened by fastidious exercise. This woman was Bayo's date. She was also, I gathered, Mystery's target. His intentions were clear because he wasn't talking to her. Instead, he had his back turned to her and was showing something to Scott Baio and his friend, a well-dressed, well-tanned 30-something who looked as if he smelled strongly of aftershave. I moved in closer. "Be careful with that," Baio was saying. "It cost $40,000. Mystery had Bayo's watch in his hands. He placed it carefully on the table. "Now watch this," he commanded. I tensed my stomach muscles, increasing the flow of oxygen to my brain, and... As Mystery waved his hands over the watch, the second hand stopped ticking. He waited 15 seconds, then waved his hands again, and slowly the watch sputtered back to life, along with Bayo's heart. Mystery's audience of four burst into applause. "Do something else," the blonde pleaded. Mystery brushed her off with a neg. "Wow, she's so demanding," he said, turning to Baio. "Is she always like this?" We were witnessing group theory in action. The more Mystery performed for the guys, the more the blonde clamored for attention. And every time, he pushed her away and continued talking with his two new friends. "I don't usually go out," Baio was telling Mystery. "I'm over it and I'm too old." After nearly 10 minutes, Mystery finally acknowledged the blonde. He held his arms out. She placed his hands in his, and he began giving her a psychic reading. He was employing a technique I'd heard about called cold reading, the art of telling people truisms about themselves without any prior knowledge of their personality or background. In the field, all knowledge, however esoteric, is power. With each accurate sentence Mystery spoke, the blonde's jaw dropped further open, until she started asking him about his job and his psychic abilities. Every response Mystery gave was intended to accentuate his youth and enthusiasm for the good life Baio said he had outgrown. "I feel so old," Mystery said, baiting her. "How old are you?" she asked. 27. "That's not old. That's perfect." He was in. Mystery called me over and whispered in my ear. He wanted me to talk to Baio and his friend, to keep them occupied while he hit on the girl. This was my first experience as a wing, a term Mystery had taken from Top Gun, along with words like target and obstacle. I struggled to make small talk with them, but Baio, looking nervously at Mystery and his date, cut me off. "Tell me this is all an illusion," he said, "and he's not actually stealing my girlfriend." 10 long minutes later, Mystery stood up, put his arm around me, and we left the club. Outside, he pulled a cocktail napkin from his jacket pocket. It contained her phone number. "Did you get a good look at her?" Mystery asked. "That is what I'm in the game for," Everything I've learned in the last decade I use tonight. It's all led up to this moment, and it worked. He beamed with self-satisfaction. How's that for a demonstration? That was all it took. Stealing a girl right out from under a celebrity's nose, has been or not, was a feat even Dustin couldn't have accomplished. Mystery was the real deal. As we took the limo to the Key Club, Mystery told us the first commandment of pickup, the 3-second rule. A man has 3 seconds after spotting a woman to speak to her, he said. If he takes any longer, then not only is the girl likely to think he's a creep who's been staring at her for too long, but he will start overthinking the approach, get nervous, and probably blow it. The moment we walked into the Key Club, Mystery put the 3-second rule into action. Striding up to a group of women, he held out his hands and asked, "What's your first impression of these?" Not the big hands, the black nails. As the girls gathered around him, Sin pulled me aside and suggested wandering the club and attempting my first approach. A group of women walked by, and I tried to say something, but the word "hi" just barely squeaked out of my throat, not even loud enough for them to hear. As they continued past us, I followed and grabbed one of the girls on the shoulder from behind. She turned around, startled, and gave me the withering, "what a creep" look that was the whole reason I was too scared to talk to women in the first place. "Never," Sin admonished me in his adenoidal voice, "approach a woman from behind. Always come in from the front, but at a slight angle so it's not too direct and confrontational. You should speak to her over your shoulder so it looks like you might walk away at any minute. Ever see Robert Redford in The Horse Whisperer? It's kinda like that." A few minutes later, I spotted a young, tipsy-looking woman with long, tangled blonde curls and a puffy pink vest standing alone. I decided that approaching her would be an easy way to redeem myself. I circled around until I was in the 10 o'clock position in front of her and walked in, imagining myself approaching a horse I didn't want to frighten. "Oh my God," I said to her, "did you see those two girls fighting outside?" "No," she said, "what happened?" She was interested. She was talking to me. It was working. Two girls were fighting over this little guy who was half their size. It was pretty brutal. He was just standing there laughing as the police came and arrested the girls. She giggled. We started talking about the club and the band playing there. She was very friendly and actually seemed grateful for the conversation. I couldn't believe that approaching a woman could be this easy. Sin sidled up to me and whispered, "Go Kino," in my ear. "What's Kino?" I asked. "Kino," the girl replied. Sin reached behind me, picked up my arm, and placed it on her shoulder. "Kino is when you touch a girl," he whispered. I felt the heat of her body and was reminded of how much I love human contact. Pets like to be petted. It isn't sexual when a dog or a cat begs for physical affection. People are the same way. We need touch. But we're so sexually screwed up and obsessed that we get nervous and uncomfortable whenever another person touches us. And unfortunately, I am no exception. As I spoke to her, my hand felt wrong on her shoulder. It was just resting there like some disembodied limb, and I imagined her wondering what exactly it was doing there and how she could gracefully extricate herself from under it. So I did her the favor of removing it myself. "Isolator," Sin said. I suggested sitting down, and we walked to a bench. Sin followed and sat behind us. As I'd been taught, I asked her to tell me the qualities she finds attractive in guys. She said humor and ass. Fortunately, I have one of those qualities. Suddenly, I felt Sin's breath on my ear. "Sniff her hair," he was instructing. I smelled her hair, although I wasn't exactly sure what the point was. I figured Sin wanted me to neg her. So I said, "It smells like smoke." "No," Sin hissed in my ear. I guess I wasn't supposed to neg. She seemed offended. So to recover, I took another whiff. But underneath that, there's a very intoxicating smell. She cocked her head to one side, furrowed her brow ever so slightly, scanned me up and down, and said, "You're weird." I was blowing it. Fortunately, Mystery soon arrived. "This place is dead," he said. "We're going somewhere more target-rich." To Mystery and Sin, these clubs didn't seem to be reality. They had no problem whispering in students' ears while they were talking to women, dropping pickup terminology in front of strangers, and even interrupting a student during a set and explaining, in front of his target, what he was doing wrong. They were so confident, and their talk was so full of incomprehensible jargon that the woman rarely even raised an eyebrow, let alone suspected they were being used to train wannabe ladies' men. I bid my new friend goodbye, as Sin had taught me, pointing to my cheek and saying, "Kiss goodbye." She actually pecked me. I felt very alpha. Chapter 4. I was in high spirits in the limo to the next bar. "Do you think I could have kissed her?" I asked Mystery. "If you think you could have, then you could have," he said. "As soon as you ask yourself whether you should or shouldn't, that means you should. And what you do is, you phase shift. Imagine a giant gear thudding down in your head, and then go for it. Start hitting on her. Tell her you just noticed she has beautiful skin, and start massaging her shoulders. But how do you know it's okay? What I do is, I look for IOIs. An IOI is an indicator of interest. If she asks you what your name is, that's an IOI. If she asks you if you're single, that's an IOI. If you take her hands and squeeze them, and she squeezes back, that's an IOI. As soon as I get 3 IOIs, I phase shift. I don't even think about it. It's like a computer program. "But how do you kiss her?" Sweater asked. I just say, "Would you like to kiss me?" And then what happens? One of 3 things, Mystery said. If she says yes, which is very rare, you kiss her. If she says maybe or hesitates, then you say, "Let's find out," and kiss her. And if she says no, you say, "I didn't say you could. It just looked like you had something on your mind." "You see," he grinned triumphantly, "you have nothing to lose. Every contingency is planned for. It's foolproof." That is the Mystery kiss close. I furiously scribbled every word of the kiss close in my notebook. No one had ever told me how to kiss a girl before. It was just one of those things men were supposed to know on their own, like shaving and car repair. Sitting in a limo with a notebook on my lap, listening to Mystery talk, I asked myself why I was really there. Taking a course in picking up women wasn't the kind of thing normal people did. Even more disturbing, I wondered why it was so important to me, why I'd become so quickly obsessed with the online community and its leading pseudonyms. Perhaps it was because attracting the opposite sex was the only area of my life in which I felt like a complete failure. Every time I walked down the street or into a bar, I saw my own failure staring me back in the face with the red lipstick and black mascara. The combination of desire and paralysis was deadly. On the last night of the workshop, Mystery and Sin took us to a bar called the Saddle Ranch, a country-themed meat market on the Sunset Strip. I'd been there before, not to pick up women, but to ride the mechanical bull. One of my goals in Los Angeles was to master the machine at its fastest setting, but not today. After 3 consecutive nights of going out until 2 a.m. and then breaking down approaches with Mystery and the other students far beyond the allotted half hour, I was wiped out. Within minutes, however, our tireless professor of pickup was at the bar, making out with a loud, tipsy girl who kept trying to steal his hat. Watching Mystery work, I noticed that he used the exact same openers, routines, and lines, and got a phone number or a tongue down nearly every time, even if the woman was with a boyfriend. I'd never seen anything like it. Sometimes a woman he was talking to was even moved to tears. As I walked toward the mechanical bull ring, feeling foolish in a red cowboy hat Mystery had insisted I wear, I saw a girl with long black hair, a form-fitting sweater, and tan legs sticking out of a ruffled skirt. She was talking animatedly to 2 guys, bouncing around them like a cartoon character. 1 second, 2 seconds, 3. "Hey, looks like the party's over here." I spoke to the guys, then turned to face the girl. I stuttered for a moment. I knew the next line. Mystery had been pushing it on me all weekend, but I'd been dreading using it. If I wasn't gay, you'd be so mine. A huge smile spread across her face. "I like your hat," she screeched, grabbing the brim. I guess peacocking did work. "Hey now," I told her, repeating a line I had heard Mr. use earlier. "Hands off the merchandise." She responded by throwing her arms around me and telling me I was fun. Every ounce of fear evaporated with her acceptance. The secret to meeting women, I realized, is simply knowing what to say and when and how to say it. "How do you all know each other?" I asked. "I just met them," she said. "My name is Elanova." She curtsied clumsily. I took that as an IOI. I showed Elanova an ESP trick Mystery had taught me earlier that evening, in which I guessed a number she was thinking between 1 and 10. Hint, it's almost always 7. And she clapped her hands together gleefully. The guys, in the presence of my superior game, wandered off. When the bar closed, Elanova and I moved outside. Every AFC we walked past gave me the thumbs up, saying, "She's hot," or "You lucky bastard." But idiots. They were fucking up my game. That is, if I could figure out a way to tell Elanova I was straight. Hopefully, she'd figured it out on her own by now. I remembered Sin telling me to Kino, so I put my arm around her. This time, however, she backed away. That was definitely not an IOI. As I took a step toward her to try again, one of the guys she'd been with in the bar arrived. She flirted with him as I stood there stupidly. When she turned back to me a few minutes later, I told her we should hang out sometime. She agreed, and we exchanged numbers. Mystery Sin and the boys were all in the limo, watching the whole exchange go down. I climbed inside, thinking I was hot shit for number closing in front of them all. But Mystery wasn't impressed. "You got that number close," he said, "because you forced yourself on her. You let her play with you." "What do you mean?" I asked. "Have I ever told you about cat string theory?" "No." "Listen, have you ever seen a cat play with a string? Well, when the string is dangling above its head, just out of reach, the cat goes crazy trying to get it. It leaps in the air, dances around, and chases it all over the room. But as soon as you let go of the string, and it drops right between the cat's paws, it just looks at the string for a second and then walks away. It's bored. It doesn't want it anymore." "So how does that apply to what just happened?" "That girl moved away from you when you put your arm around her, and you ran right back to her like a puppy dog. You should have punished her, turned away and talked to someone else, let her work to get your attention back. After that, she made you wait while she talked to that dork." "What should I have done?" "You should have said, 'I'll let you two be alone,' and started to walk away, as if you were giving her to him, even though you knew she liked you more. You have to act like you are the prize." I smiled. I think I really understood. "Yeah," he said. "Be the dancing string." I grew silent and thought about it, kicking my legs up against the bar counter of the limousine and slouching into the seat. Mystery turned to Sin, and they talked amongst themselves for several minutes. It felt like they were discussing me. I tried not to make eye contact with them. I wondered if they were going to tell me that I'd held the workshop up, that I wasn't yet ready for it, that I should study for another 6 months and then take it again. Suddenly, Mystery and Sin ended their huddle. Mystery broke into a wide smile and looked straight at me. "You're one of us," he said. "You're going to be a superstar." Chapter 5. Sure, there's Ovid, the Latin poet who wrote The Art of Love. The Duc de Lauzon, one of the legendary Spanish lovers who inspired the Don Juan legend. And Casanova, who detailed his 100+ conquests in 4,000 pages of memoirs. But the undisputed father of modern seduction is Ross Jeffries, a tall, skinny, porous-faced, self-proclaimed nerd from Marina del Rey, California. Guru, cult leader, and social gadfly, he commands an army 60,000 horny men strong, including top government officials, intelligence officers, and cryptographers. His weapon is his voice. After years of studying everyone from master hypnotists to Hawaiian kahunas, he claims to have found the technology, and make no mistake about it, that's what it is, that will turn any responsive woman into a libidinous puddle. Jeffries, who claims to be the inspiration for Tom Cruise's character in Magnolia, calls it speed seduction. Jeffries developed speed seduction in 1982, after ending a 5-year streak of sexlessness with the help of neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP, a controversial fusion of hypnosis and psychology that emerged from the personal development boom of the 1970s and led to the rise of self-help gurus like Anthony Robbins. The fundamental precept of NLP is that one's thoughts, feelings, and behavior, as well as the thoughts, feelings, and behavior of others, can be manipulated through words, suggestions, and physical gestures designed to influence the subconscious. The potential of NLP to revolutionize the art of seduction was obvious to Jeffries. Over the years, Jeffries has either outlasted, sued, or crushed any competitor in the field of pickup to make his school, speed seduction, the dominant model for getting a woman's lips to touch a man's. That is, until Mystery came along and started teaching workshops. Thus, the clamor online for an eyewitness account of Mystery's first workshop was overwhelming. Mystery's admirers wanted to know if the class was worthwhile. His enemies, particularly Jeffries and his disciples, wanted to tear him apart. So I obliged, posting a detailed description of my experiences. At the end of my review, I issued a call for wings in Los Angeles, asking only that they be somewhat confident, intelligent, and socially comfortable. I knew that in order to become a pickup artist myself, I would somehow have to internalize everything I had seen Mystery do. This would happen only through practice, through hitting the bars and clubs every night until I became a natural like Dustin, or even an unnatural like Mystery. The day my report on the workshop hit the internet, I received an email from someone in Encino named Grimble, who identified himself as a Ross Jeffries student. He wanted to sarge with me, as he put it. Sarging is pickup artist jargon for going out to meet women. The term evidently has its origins in the name of one of Ross Jeffries' cats, Sargy. An hour after I sent him my phone number, Grimble called. More than Mystery, it was Grimble who would initiate me into what could only be described as a secret society. "Hey, man," he said in a conspiratorial hiss. "So what do you think of Mystery's game?" I gave him my assessment. "Wow, I like it," he said. "But you have to hang out with Two-Timer and me sometime. We've been sergeant with Ross Jeffries a lot." "Really? I'd love to meet him." "Listen, can you keep a secret?" "Sure." "How much technology do you use in your sarges?" "Technology? You know, how much is technique and how much is just talking?" "I guess 50-50, I said. "I'm up to 90%. "What?" "Yeah, I use a canned opener, then I elicit her values and find out her trance words. And then I go into one of the secret patterns. Do you know the October Man sequence?" Never heard of it unless Arnold Schwarzenegger was in it." "Oh man, I had a girl over here last week, and I gave her a whole new identity. I did a sexual value elicitation, and then changed her whole timeline and internal reality. Then I brushed my finger along her face, telling her to notice. And here he switched into a slow, hypnotic voice. How wherever I touch, it leaves a trail of energy moving through you. And wherever you can feel this energy spreading, the deeper you want to allow yourself to feel these sensations, becoming even more intense." "And then what?" "And then I brushed my finger along her lips, and she started sucking it," he exclaimed triumphantly. "Full close." "Wow," I said. I had no idea what he was talking about, but I wanted this technology. I thought back to all the times I'd taken women to my house, sat on the bed next to them, leaned in for the kiss, and been deflected with the "let's just be friends" speech. In fact, this rejection is such a universal experience that Ross Jeffries invented not just an acronym for it, LJBF, let's just be friends, but a litany of responses as well. I talked to Grimble for 2 hours. He seemed to know everybody, from legends like Steve P., who supposedly had a cult of women paying cash for the privilege of sexually servicing him, to guys like Rick H., Ross's most famous student, thanks to an incident that involved him, a hot tub, and 5 women. Grimble would make a perfect wing. Chapter 6. I drove to Grimble's house in Encino the following night to go sarging. This would be my first time in the field since Mystery's workshop. It would also be my first time hanging out one-on-one with a stranger I'd met online. All I really knew about him was that he was a college student and he liked girls. When I pulled up, Grimble strode outside and flashed a big smile I didn't quite trust. He didn't seem dangerous or mean. He just seemed slippery, like a politician or a salesman, or, I suppose, a seducer. He had the complexion of barley tea, though he was actually German. In fact, he claimed to be a descendant of Nietzsche. He wore a brown leather jacket over a floral print shirt, which was unbuttoned to reveal an eerily hairless chest thrust out further than his nose. In his hands was a plastic bag full of videotapes, which he dumped into the back of my car. He reminded me of a mongoose. "These are some of Ross's seminars," he said. "You'll really like the DC seminar, because he gets into synesthesia there. The other tapes are from Kim and Tom, Ross's ex-girlfriend and her new boyfriend. It's their New York seminar, advanced anchoring, and other sneaky stuff." "What's anchoring?" I asked. "My wing Two-Timer will show you when you meet him. Ever experienced condiment anchoring before?" I had so much to learn. Men generally don't communicate to one another with the same level of emotional depth and intimate detail as most women. Women discuss everything. When a man sees his friends after getting laid, they ask, "How'd it go?" And in return, he gives them either a thumbs up or a thumbs down. That's how it's done. To discuss the experience in detail would mean giving your friends mental images they don't really want to have. It is a taboo among men to picture their best friends naked or having sex, because then they might find themselves aroused, and we all know what that means. So, ever since I'd started harboring sexual thoughts in sixth grade, I'd assumed that sex was something that just happened to guys if they went out a lot and exposed themselves to chance. After all, that's why they called it getting lucky. The only tool they had in their belt was persistence. Of course, there were some men who were sexually comfortable around women, who would tease them mercilessly until they had them eating out of their hands. But that wasn't me. It took all of my courage to simply ask a woman for the time or where Melrose Avenue was. I didn't know anything about anchoring, eliciting values, finding trance words, or these other things Grimble kept talking about. How did I ever get laid without all this technology? It was a quiet Tuesday night in the valley, and the only place Grimble knew to go was the local TGI Fridays. In the car, we warmed up, listening to cassette tapes of Sarge's by Rick H., practicing openers, faking smiles, and dancing in our seats to get energetic. It was one of the most ridiculous things I'd ever done, but I was entering a new world now, with its own rules of behavior. We walked in the door of the restaurant, confident, smiling, alpha. Unfortunately, no one noticed. There were two guys at the bar watching a baseball game on television, a group of business people at a corner table, and a mostly male bar staff. We strutted out to the balcony. As we pushed the door open, a woman appeared. Time to put what I'd learned to the test. "Hey," I said to her, "let me get your opinion on something." She stopped and listened. She was about 4'10", with short frizzy hair and a marshmallow body, but she had a nice smile. She would be good practice. I decided to use the Maury Povich opener. "My friend Grimble there just got a call today from the Maury Povich show," I began. "And it seems they're doing a show on secret admirers. Evidently, someone has a little crush on him. Do you think he should go on the show or not?" "Sure," she answered. "Why not?" "But what if his secret admirer is a man?" I asked. "Talk shows always need to put an unexpected twist on everything. Or what if it's a relative?" "It's not lying. It's flirting." She laughed. "Perfect. Would you do the show?" I asked. "Probably not," she answered. Suddenly, Grimble stepped in. "So you would make me go on the show, but you wouldn't do it yourself?" he teased her. "You're not adventurous at all, are you?" It was great to watch him work. Where I would have let the conversation wane into small talk, he was already leading her somewhere sexual. "I am," she protested. "Then prove it to me," he said, smiling. "Let's try a little exercise. It's called synesthesia." He took a step closer to her. "Have you ever heard of synesthesia? It will enable you to find all kinds of resources to accomplish and feel the things you want in life. Synesthesia is the nerve gas in the arsenal of the speed seducer. Literally, it is an overlapping of the senses. In the context of seduction, however, synesthesia refers to a type of waking hypnosis in which a woman is put into a heightened state of awareness and told to imagine pleasurable images and sensations growing in intensity. The goal? To make her uncontrollably aroused. She agreed and closed her eyes. I was finally going to get to hear one of Ross's secret patterns. But as soon as Grimble began, a stocky red-faced jock wearing a pocket undershirt marched up to him. "What are you doing?" he asked Grimble. "I was showing her a self-improvement exercise called synesthesia." "Well, that's my wife." I had forgotten to check for a wedding ring, though I doubted minor inconveniences like marriage mattered to Grimble. "Go disarm the guy," Grimble turned to me and hissed, "while I work on the girl." I had no idea how to disarm him. He didn't seem quite as laid back as Scott Baio. "He can show you the exercise too," I said wanly. "It's really cool." "I don't know what the fuck you're talking about," the guy said. "What is this thing supposed to do to me?" He took a step closer and leaned his face into mine. He smelled like whiskey and onion rings. "It tells you whether, I stammered. Never mind. The guy lifted his hands and pushed me backward. Though I tell girls I'm 5'8", I'm actually 5'6". The top of my head just reached his shoulders. Stop it, his wife, our former Sarge, said. She turned to us. He's drunk. He gets like this. Like what, I asked, violent? She smiled sadly. You seem like a great couple, I said. My attempt to disarm him had clearly failed, because he was about to disarm me. His red, drunken face was 2 inches from mine, and yelling about ripping something. Pleasure meeting you both, I squeaked, slowly backing away. Remind me, Grimble said as we retreated to the car, to teach you how to handle the AMOG. The AMOG? Yes, the alpha male of the group. Oh, I see. Chapter 7. 4 days later, as I sat at home alone on a Saturday afternoon, watching the videos Grimble had given me, he called with good news. He and his wing two-timer were going to meet Ross Jeffries at California Pizza Kitchen for an expedition to the Getty Museum, and I was invited. I arrived 15 minutes early, selected a booth, and read through printouts of seduction board posts until Ross, Grimble, and two-timer arrived. Two-timer had black hair, gelled to the texture of a licorice vine, a matching leather jacket, and a snake-like quality. With his round, babyish face, he looked like a Grimble clone who'd been inflated by a bicycle pump. As I stood up to introduce myself, Ross cut me off. He was not the most polite person I'd ever met. He wore a long wool overcoat, which flowed loosely around his legs when he walked. He was thin and gawky, with gray stubble and greasy skin. His hairline was a receding mop of short, unkempt, ash-colored curls, and a hook in his nose was so pronounced he could have hung his overcoat on it. So, what did you learn from mystery? Ross asked with a sneer. A lot, I told him. Like what? Well, one of my sticking points was knowing when a girl was attracted to me. Now I know. And how do you know? He asked. When I get 3 indicators of interest. Name them. Let's see. When she asks you what your name is? That's 1. When you take her hands in yours and squeeze them, and she squeezes back? That's 2. And, I can't remember the rest right now. Aha! He leapt to his feet. Then he's not a very good teacher, is he? No, he was a great teacher, I protested. Then name the 3rd indicator of interest. I can't think of it right now. I felt like an animal backed into a corner. Case closed, he said. He was good. A short waitress with blue nails, a touch of baby fat, and sandy brown hair arrived to take our order. Ross looked at her and then winked at me. These are my students, he told her. I'm their guru. Really? She asked, feigning interest. What would you say if I told you that I teach people how to use mind control to attract any person they desire? Get out of here. Yes, it's true. I could make you fall in love with any person at this table. How's that, with mind control? She was skeptical, but bordering on curious. Let me ask you something. When you're really attracted to somebody, how do you know? In other words, what signals do you get from yourself, inside, that allow you to realize? And here he lowered his voice, slowly pronouncing each word. You're really attracted to this guy. The purpose of the question, I would find out later, was to make the waitress feel the emotion of attraction in his presence, and thus associate those feelings with his face. She thought about it for a moment. Well, I got a funny feeling in my stomach, like butterflies, when I met my ex-boyfriend. Ross put his hand palm up in front of his stomach. Yes, and I bet that the more attracted you become, the more those butterflies rise up from your stomach. He began slowly raising his hand to the level of his heart, till your face begins to flush, like it is right now. Two-timer leaned over and whispered, That's anchoring. It's when you associate a physical feeling, like attraction, with a touch or gesture. Now, every time Ross raises his hand like that, she gets attracted to him. After a few more minutes of Ross's flirtatious hypnospeak, the waitress's eyes began to glaze over. Ross seized the opportunity to toy with her mercilessly. He raised his hands like an elevator, from his stomach to his face, every few seconds, smiling as it made her blush every time. The dishes she was carrying were forgotten, balancing precariously on her weakening arm. What made you break up with your boyfriend? Ross asked after a while. He was too immature. Ross seized the opportunity. Well, you should date more mature men. I was just thinking that about you as we were talking, she giggled. I bet that when you first came to the table, I was the last person you thought you'd be attracted to. It's strange, she said, because you're not my usual type. Ross suggested they get together for coffee when she wasn't working, and she jumped at the opportunity to give him her phone number. His technique was so different than Mystery's, but he seemed to be the real deal, too. As we left the restaurant, Ross ran the exact same routine on the hostess and collected her number. Both women were in their 20s. Ross was in his 40s. I was floored. We pressed into Ross's Saab and headed to the Getty. Anything you want from a woman, attraction, lust, fascination, is just an internal process that she runs through her body and her brain, he explained as he drove. And all you need to evoke that process are questions that make her go into her body and brain and actually experience it in order to answer you. Then she will link those feelings of attraction to you. Sitting in the back seat with me, two-timer scanned my face for a reaction. What do you think? He asked. Amazing, I said. Evil, he corrected, letting a thin smile creep over his lips. When we arrived at the Getty, two-timer turned his attention to Ross. I wanted to ask you about the October Man sequence, he prodded. I've been switching around a few of the steps. Ross turned to him. You understand that these things are very bad. As he spoke, Ross wagged a finger at two-timer's chest, over his heart. He was anchoring again, trying to associate the notion of badness with the forbidden pattern. There's a reason I don't teach them at my seminars. It's like giving dynamite to children. Two-timer smiled again. I could tell exactly what he was thinking, because in my mind, the word evil was anchored to that smile. Darwin talked about survival of the fittest, two-timer explained to me as we walked through the museum's collection of pre-20th century art. In earlier times, this meant that the strong survived, but strength doesn't help one get ahead in society today. Women breed with seducers, who understand how to trigger the fantasy parts of the female brain. There was something artificial and rehearsed about the way he spoke, the way he moved, the way he looked at me. It felt as if he were sucking my soul into his eyes. So the whole idea of survival of the fittest is an anachronism. As players, we stand at the gate of a new era, the survival of the smoothest. I liked the idea, though unfortunately I was no smoother than I was strong. My voice was fast and choppy, my movements effete, my body language awkward. For me, survival was going to take work. Casanova was one of us, two-timer went on, but we live a better lifestyle. Well, it probably took a lot more work to seduce a woman back then, because of the morals of the day, I said, trying to contribute something useful. And we have the technology. You mean NLP? Not just that. He had to work alone. He grinned as his gaze bored deeper into my eyes. We have each other. We lurked through the galleries, gazing at the people gazing at paintings. I watched as Grimble and Two-Timer talked to various women. I was far too scared to approach in front of Ross. It felt like trying to play the cello in front of Yo-Yo Ma. I was afraid he'd criticize everything I did or get upset that I wasn't using enough of his technology. On the other hand, this was a guy who advised students to get over their fear of approaching by walking up to random women and saying, "Hi, I'm Manny the Martian. What's your favorite flavor of bowling ball?" So I really didn't have to worry about looking foolish in front of him. He created fools. At the end of the day, Ross had three numbers. Two-timer and Grimble had two each, and I had nothing. As we took the train downhill to the museum parking lot, Ross slid into the seat next to me. "Listen," he said, "I have a seminar coming up in a few months, and I will let you sit in and take it for free." "Thanks," I said. "I am going to be your guru, not Mystery. You'll see that what I am teaching is 100 times more powerful." I wasn't sure how to respond. They were competing over me, an AFC, an average frustrated chump. "And one more thing," Ross said. "In exchange, I want you to take me to 5, no 6, Hollywood parties with super hot babes." He smiled and asked, "Do we have a deal?" as he rubbed his thumb on his chin. I was sure he was anchoring me. Step 3. Demonstrate value. Chapter 1. The best predators don't lie on the jungle floor with their teeth bared and claws out. The prey is going to avoid them. They approach the prey slowly and harmlessly, win its trust, and then attack. At least, that's what Sin told me. He facetiously called it Sin Method. Though Mystery had flown back to Toronto after the workshop, I stayed in touch with Sin. I'd watch as a woman came over to his house for the first time, and he'd throw her against the wall by her neck, then release her, just before he kissed her, shooting her adrenaline level through the roof, with equal parts fear and arousal. Then he'd cook her dinner and never speak a word about it until dessert, when he'd stare at her like a tiger eyeing its prey and say, in a tone of restrained lust, "You don't even want to know the things I'm thinking of doing to you right now." That was generally the point when I'd excuse myself to go home. Along with the sneakier Grimple, the more predatory Sin became a faithful wing. But our friendship didn't last long. One afternoon, after a sergeant session at the Beverly Center Mall, Sin informed me that he'd enrolled in the Air Force as an officer. "The military's a steady paycheck," he explained as we sat in a mall cafe, "and I can live wherever I want,